The new generation of Jesuit Vatican-controlled agents are now attempting to split the United States once more using the same tactics of divide and conquer even today. We find Jesuit and Vatican connections all over the John Birch Society, the Tea Party, the Truth Movement. This is why each and every one of you must be concerned with alleged truth-tellers and their affiliations with these groups and their members who are seeking to radicalize Christians into armed conflict, which will allow them to achieve civil war and assume total control.
This country, April 15th, it's tax day, or tax extension day for some. For others, this was Tea Party Day. All across this country, Americans gathered in parks and plazas and in Washington, D.C. to show their government they're fed up with the way things are going. Our own Kelly O'Donnell's with us from the National Mall tonight. Kelly, good evening.
Good evening, Brian. For the Tea Party movement, this is something of a political holiday, using tax day to make their case. They don't like where the country is headed. They don't like the size of government. And more than one was willing to tell me they don't like the media. But they all do want to be heard.
In the law of the land,
going right to the source.
For you sent a message.
Tea Partiers rallied in Washington, the very place their movement wants to change.
5 years ago, I would never have been here. Now, I feel a responsibility to stand up and at least with these other folks here and say, someone listen.
Wading through the crowd, there are at least two different kinds of issues. All the political distrust.
Is it frustration?
Total frustration. Total frustration with a health care plan that does nothing to reduce costs.
And skepticism over how the Tea Party is judged and labeled.
We're not racist. We're not any of the above that people claim us to be. We're ordinary citizens that love our country, and we're fighting for it.
I've lost count of how many Tea Parties I've been to.
With rallies across the country today, the Tea Party mobilized a year ago in opposition to health care reform, government spending, and taxes.
There aren't a lot of African-American men at these events.
Right.
Have you ever felt uncomfortable?
No, these are my people. Americans.
A new CBS News New York Times poll finds 18% of Americans say they support the movement. Within that group, most are white men over 45, better educated and wealthier than the general public.
Do you think this has enough energy to really last to November and to make a difference?
Oh, yes.
Why?
Because it's the people. It's not a party. It's the people. The people are angry, and they're organized.
I don't know how much traction there is, how much this thing is, this old Tea Party idea is getting. I mean, I just don't know. I don't pay attention to it. I don't know. I don't know what shows and what networks out there are promoting it, you know. I don't know whether all the shows promoting it or whoever, but from Veterans Today, and it's interesting because something I didn't know, it checks out right with my Council for National Policy research, and I can verify that what is said in this article is true because of the research and stuff that I've done on the group, and it's in my film. But I want to read this for you. Stolen Patriotism, Patriot Groups Unmasked by Gordon Duff of Veterans Today. Friends, some former Ron Paul supporters are now being courted by radicals, stretching a new revolution of working class Americans against Obama and his big business supporters. www.resistnet.org is one of their biggest voices. In truth, our heroic gun-toting woodsmen are actually following Washington, D.C. public relations from Shirley and Bannister Public Affairs, a front group for the Bush family in the insurance industry. The tough guys are being organized into militia units to march on Washington, D.C., are being led by a front group funded by Westinghouse Corporation, Prudential Insurance, Aetna Insurance, the DuPont family, and the Forbes family. Now, what's interesting is the DuPont family has members in the Council for National Policy, and, of course, the Forbes family, Steve Forbes, is a member. So that right there alone, and I should have known this was being, you know, I didn't even talk about it. I said, you know what, I was sitting there thinking to myself, you know what, I bet this Tea Party thing is being organized by these Council for National Policy types. Lo and behold, you know, I didn't have to even go look. There it is. Yet another, I mean, it's all connected back to them, folks. Everything in the Patriot Movement connects back to these clowns. Everything. The DuPont family, the Forbes family, McDonnell Douglas nuclear power plant builders, and about 100 groups made of Washington's lawyers and lobbyists. With embarrassment, organizing all this libertarian protest is the biggest client of all, the Republican National Committee. The secret is out. You've been had, duped, snookered, and suckered. The group warning us about the New World Order is actually being led by people they're supposed to be against. Yeah! Yeah! Thank you! You just figured that out, huh? Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, tell me about it, brother. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, the New World Order is actually being led by people warnings about the New World Order is actually being led by these people that are in the New World Order.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been up here screaming about this for 2+ years. Well, I'm telling you, people are figuring it out, folks.
Now that we've looked at the origins of the Truth Movement and Patriot Movement, in this section we're going to dig deeper into the Council for National Policy, which was the subject of our first film on this subject, The Secret Right, Volume 1. Now, in that film, we delved more into the Council for National Policy side of it and really tried to raise awareness on the group. And I think that in the 2 years since that film has been released, we definitely have done that with now the Council for National Policy and the people associated with it becoming a major question in the search for answers regarding the world system. So here in this segment of the film, we're going to dig deeper into the Council for National Policy, look at some of their deeper connections. And as you'll see, it ties right back to the priest class, the Jesuit order, and as always, all roads lead to Rome.
In 1972, the John Birch Society promoted the book None Dare Call It Treason by John Stormer, which identified the Council on Foreign Relations as a pro-communist Rockefeller-funded Trojan horse on American soil. The Council for National Policy was formed ostensibly to be the alternative to the Council on Foreign Relations, and John Stormer was a member of both. Since its inception, CMP membership directories have been confidential. CMP meetings are closed to the public and media, and the very existence of the Council for National Policy is denied by high-profile leaders who publicly clamor for conservative policies in government. Responding to an inquiry by researcher K.E. Barr regarding the nature of the CMP and the reasons the meetings are closed, even to Christian media, a vice president of Focus on the Family presented the confused image of a Christian organization that is not involved in policymaking and yet cannot risk media exposure. Paul Hetrick repeatedly described the organization as a meeting of like-minded people. He claimed that the CMP is a group of conservatives concerned about the direction of the country, who felt the need for an organization to counter the liberal agenda. He said the network of leaders from across the country meet 2 to 3 times a year to discuss issues involving free enterprise, defense, and traditional Western values. Early CMP membership directories were obtained by enterprising researchers. These reveal that the early leadership of the CMP was, in fact, also represented in the Council on Foreign Relations, the very organization of globalists to which the CMP was to be the conservative alternative. On the first CMP governing board, there were no less than 3 and possibly more members of the CFR. George F. Gilder, CMP Board of Governors, 1982. Dr. Edward Teller, CMP Board of Governors, 1982, father of the hydrogen bomb. And Guy Vanderjack, CMP Board of Governors, 1982. Robert Waring Stoddard, who also served on the 1982 CMP Board of Governors, was affiliated with the CFR through his Boston newspaper. Ron Miller, author of Distant Drums, stated that sources in high places have identified Jesse Helms as a CFR member. Helms also served on the original CMP Board of Governors. Later CMP directories list CFR members J. Peter Grace, head of the Knights of Malta in America until his death, and Arnold de Borchgrave, the CMP, 1988. After CMP membership directories were obtained by researchers and copied for distribution to Christians who support CMP organizations, venues of future meetings were not included in their directories. However, researchers were made privy to a 1998 CMP meeting that was held at the luxury Ritz-Carlton Tysons Corner Hotel in McLean, Virginia. Profiles of other prominent CMP officers and members reveal a shocking number of CFR connections, such as the aforementioned William Rusher, who was editor of CFR member William F. Buckley's National Review. Even so, these revelations should not be surprising, since the CMP was an extension of the John Birch Society, whose early leadership consisted of members either directly or indirectly associated with the Council on Foreign Relations. In 1976, the Belmont Brotherhood, an expose published by former John Birch Society officers, identified the following glaring conflicts of interest. William Greedy, founding John Birch Society Council member and chairman of the Executive Committee of the Council, was also director of the CFR and created and controlled the 7th Federal Reserve Bank. William Benton McMillan, first life member of the John Birch Society, was also a member of the St. Louis Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. Robert Waring Stoddard, John Birch Society Council member and chairman of the board of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, whose editors belonged to the local committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. Stoddard was also on the board of directors for the National Center for Privatization. J. Nelson Shepard, John Birch Society Council member and a member of the Newcomen Society, whose president, Charles Penrose Jr., was also a member of the Pilgrim Society, and the English-speaking Union, whose elite membership included Paul Warburg, J.P. Morgan, John W. Davis, Bernard Baruch, Otto Kahn, Jacob Schiff, and John D. Rockefeller, to name a few. It was founded and financed by the Council on Foreign Relations. Spurrell Braden, John Birch Society Council member and a resident member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a director of the W. Averill Harriman Securities Corporation, and an advisor to Paul Warburg, a principal architect of the Federal Reserve System. Louis Ruthenberg, John Birch Society Council member and director of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Cola Godden Parker, John Birch Society Council member and a member of the Newcomen Society, whose president, Charles Penrose Jr., belonged to the Pilgrim Society and the English-speaking Union. Martin J. Condon III, John Birch Society non-council member who was on the editorial advisory committee of American Opinion Magazine and was also a member of the Newcomen Society. Charles Edison, John Birch Society council member who served on the editorial advisory committee of the American Opinion Magazine and was a member of the Pilgrim-connected Newcomen Society. Dr. Edward Teller, who was on the CMP Board of Governors in 1982, was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and was a Hungarian-born American physicist who became the father of the hydrogen bomb and the real-life Dr. Strangelove. During World War II, he was a member of the Manhattan Project for the development of the atomic bomb. Teller was a member of the Citizens Legal Defense Fund for the FBI and Majestic 12. He headed up Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative under Reagan and got the contract with Arco Oil on behalf of the Defense Department to use the HARP project Arco had developed for earth-penetrating tomography for military purposes. Dr. Edward Teller, along with CMP member Lawrence E. King and CIA asset and MKUltra leader Michael Aquino, are said to have been a part of a massive child sex slave ring that provided young boys and girls to high-level Republican deviants for occult sex rituals at places like the Bohemian Grove. One reported victim by the name of Jim Shaw, now deceased, claims he was forced from childhood to become one of Ed Teller's boys that Teller used in rituals not only in the Bohemian Grove, but also in other rituals nationwide as well as in Hollywood. From the time Jim Shaw was turned over as a child to Edward Teller, he was used for pornographic and pedophilic purposes, forced to sacrifice babies under Teller's orders and controls, and used sexually in such rituals as well. He was introduced to Teller's many Jewish friends in Hollywood and passed around to big names and Hollywood producers acquainted with Teller. He was to be sexually abused and often beat up for sport as well. During his time, Edward Teller was also a big financial supporter of a display making the rounds across America perpetuating the Holocaust Memorial. He even traveled with it at one point. Interestingly, after Jim became an adult and still under Teller's control, Jim was also trained and used in the Mossad and various operations. According to Kathy O'Brien, one of our primary mind control programmers was Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino. He was with the Psychological Warfare Division of the U.S. Army and founder of the occult temple of Set that is proliferating on our military bases under the guise of a religion, she said. He doesn't have any religious beliefs that I ever saw, but he used occultism as a trauma base for mind control. The only satanic power that I ever experienced by Aquino was in the form of a stun gun. The high voltage that he administered to both my daughter and I compartmentalized memories of programs for later access by certain government leaders and CIA-sanctioned drug lords that had the codes, keys, and triggers to that program. Aquino, Teller, and King are all said to have had a hand in the kidnapping of Johnny Gosch.
For most American families, this holiday weekend marks the unofficial end of summer. For one family, it also marks a chilling anniversary, one that has made an entire nation aware of the question, have you seen this child? James Satori reports.
Early mornings in Des Moines are still haunted by the memory of a 12-year-old paper boy whose disappearance thrust the issue of missing children onto the front page.
I took this picture of Johnny the first day of his paper out, roughly a year before he was kidnapped.
For John and Noreen Gosch, it's an unending horror story which has left them numb.
I believe it was an organized effort. It was planned, premeditated. They knew who they were coming after and that he was sought out for either prostitution or pornography and was in fact sold.
It was 10 years ago this weekend that Johnny Gosch set out on his newspaper route early on a Sunday morning in the suburban Des Moines neighborhood. As they gathered their stacks, a couple of the other paper boys noticed a man driving by and stopping to talk with Johnny. That was the last time he was seen here. Searchers found no sign of the youngster, though witnesses helped produce a composite sketch of the suspect. Then came sightings and psychics, hundreds of leads.
We've had several phone calls. Noreen received one that she said it sounded a lot like Johnny's voice.
Gosh's case sparked the nationwide campaign using milk cartons to publicize missing children, but it didn't help find Johnny or his abductors.
There is absolutely nothing preventing them from taking another paper boy or a little girl or whoever they choose.
It did happen to another paper boy. Eugene Martin disappeared in 1984 under remarkably similar circumstances. And while neither case has been solved, they have left their mark.
Police react very quickly now. We have a missing persons clearinghouse in the state of Iowa, which we never had before. And that was the result of these two cases.
Thank you.
The Gosh's crusade for the truth now focuses on a child molester imprisoned in Nebraska. Paul Bonacci claimed last year that he was part of a gang which abducted Johnny Gosh.
One that they picked out and said that this is the one that they wanted, and it was a picture of what I later found out was Johnny.
Police dismissed Bonacci as mentally disturbed and unreliable. The best shot at finding Johnny Gosh may be this computer-enhanced photo.
This is Johnny at 23 years of age.
Someone knows what happened to Johnny Gosh. Someone knows where Johnny is.
And the Goshes are still waiting to hear.
I would want him to know that we love him and that we have tried very hard over these 10 years to find him and that he's been missed in this family. And we'll live with this till the day we die.
James Hattori, CBS News, West Des Moines, Iowa.
Gosh, who was allegedly sold into the child sex slave rings that King, Aquino, and Teller participated in, writing in her book, Why Johnny Can't Come Home, Noreen Gosh, Johnny Gosh's mother, wrote, quote, "It was reported to me and given in federal court, February 1999, by Paul Bonacci, that Michael Aquino, called the Colonel, was in fact the man who came to Iowa, paid the kidnappers for taking Johnny, and then took Johnny with him. This took place 14 days after the kidnapping. Bonacci stated this under oath in federal court. Judge Urban ruled Bonacci was telling the truth. Johnny Gosh was the first child ever featured on a milk carton and is believed to be gay male porn star and National Press Club member James Guckert, a.k.a. Jeff Gannon. Notice how all the aliases start with J.G., as in Johnny Gosh. Paul Bonacci also testified under oath and lie detector that he was used to lure Johnny Gosh to the kidnappers. During the February 5th hearing, Noreen Gosh stunned the court with sworn testimony linking U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino to the nationwide pedophile ring her son Johnny, then 12 years old, was kidnapped off the streets of West Des Moines, Iowa on September 5th, 1982, while he was doing his early morning newspaper deliveries. Since his kidnapping, she has devoted all of her time and resources to finding her son and to exposing the dangers that millions of children in America face from this hideous, literally satanic underground of ritualistic deviance. Then the Aquino bombshell. Quote, "Well, then there was a man by the name of Michael Aquino. He was in the military. He had top Pentagon clearance. He was a pedophile. He was a Satanist. He founded the Temple of Set, and he was a close friend of Anton LaVey. The two of them were very active in ritualistic sexual abuse, and they deferred funding from this government program to use this experimentation on children." Under questioning from John DeCamp, Gosh reported, "I know that Michael Aquino has been in Iowa. I know that Michael Aquino has been to Offutt Air Force Base, Strategic Air Command Base near Omaha, which was linked to Lawrence King's activities. I know that he has had contact with many of these children." Another incident which linked King to Aquino. King and Aquino were seen at a posh hotel in downtown Minneapolis, where he personally saw King turn over a suitcase full of cash and bearer bonds to the colonel, whom later he positively identified as Aquino. According to Nelson, King told him that the suitcase of cash and bonds were earmarked from the Nicaraguan Contras, and that the colonel was part of the covert Contra support apparatus, otherwise associated with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, CMP member who we discussed in Volume 1. Vice President George Bush and the secret parallel government that they ran from the White House were also involved. On August 14, 1987, San Francisco police raided Aquino's Russian Hill home, which he shared with his wife, Lilith. The raid was in response to allegations that the house had been the scene of a brutal rape of a four-year-old girl. The principal suspect in the rape, a Baptist minister named Gary Hambright, was indicted in September 1987 on charges that he committed lewd and lascivious acts with six boys and four girls, ranging in age from 3 to 7 years. During September to October 1986, at the same time of the alleged sex crimes, Hambright was employed at a Child Care Center on U.S. Army base at Presidio. In 1982, the Temple of Set fissured over the issue of Aquino's emphasis on Nazism. One leader, Ronald K. Barrett, shortly after his expulsion, wrote that Aquino had taken the Temple of Set in an explicitly satanic direction with strong overtones of German National Socialist Nazi occultism. Aquino was deeply involved in what has been called the Revolution in Military Affairs, RMA, the introduction of the most kooky third-wave New Age ideas into military long-range planning, which introduced such notions as information warfare and cyber warfare into the Pentagon's lexicon. Aquino coined the phrase and the idea of information warfare or InfoWars. It's safe to say that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. In the early 1980s, at the time that Heidi and Alvin Toffler were spinning their Tavistock third-wave utopian claptrap with some top Air Force brass, Aquino and another U.S. Army colonel, Paul Vallely, were co-authoring an article for Military Review. Although the article was never published in the journal, the article titled From Psyop to Mind War, The Psychology of Victory, endorsed some of the ideas published in a 1980 Military Review article by Lieutenant Colonel John Alexander, an affiliate of the Stanford Research Institute, a hotbed of Tavistock Institute and Frankfurt School New Age Social Engineering. Aquino and Vallely called for an explicitly Nietzschean form of warfare, which they dubbed mind war. Like the sword Excalibur, they wrote, we have but to reach out and seize this tool, and it can transform the world for us, if we have but the courage and the integrity to guide civilization with it. If we do not accept Excalibur, then we relinquish our ability to inspire foreign cultures with our morality. If they then devise moralities unsatisfactory to us, we have no choice but to fight them on a more brutish level. For Aquino, mind war is a permanent state of strategic psychological warfare against the populations of friend and foe nations alike. Above all else, Aquino argues, mind war must target the population of the United States. Aquino has also funneled money from the CIA to Adnan Khashoggi, provided the weapons during Iran-Contra. We'll discuss Khashoggi more later in the film. Although he denies it, Aquino was also said to have brought about the New Age military tactics seen in the movie and book The Men Who Stare at Goats. The Men Who Stare at Goats was written by John Ronson, the same person who wrote them based on his experience of sneaking into the Bohemian Grove with Alex Jones, which I feel was a total setup.
Respected law enforcement professional, recently or retired now from the FBI, former regional director of Los Angeles, do you, sir, believe that these dreadful allegations of babies being sacrificed are true?
I absolutely believe it, without any doubt. Based on the information that's been given to me across the country by numerous survivors and by confidential sources and informants.
Then why don't you name these people and arrest them? Never a name, never an arrest. These women come out of a group and they insist that they know the people in the group, and yet they do not identify these large, mysterious cults. Name them and arrest them and get them off the street. Does he not make a valid point?
He makes a valid point. The problem with that is, number one, police officers don't believe it. I may believe it. You may believe it. Some people in your audience may believe it. They don't believe it. Number two, if you decide to investigate these people, you have to, number one, handle it from an undercover operation. If you put an undercover operation into effect, then you have, in a sense, your own police officers become involved in these heinous crimes, and they are, of course, become murderers. And in addition to that, if you do decide to investigate these people, it's a lot of work. And many law enforcement officers are apathetic and don't want to get involved.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard this. The debate here could rage over this issue alone for hours and hours and hours. Michael Aquino is right when he says there have not been any successful prosecutions for this horrible allegation. Ted Gunnarsson is a sincere man with a good reputation who says that there are difficulties in the prosecution. Still, the point is it has never been proven in a court of law. Obviously, it needs more investigation, but if these things are happening, then there should be a national task force of federal and state and local cops working together to prove or disprove. Because this is just unacceptable, this impasse. Coming up, we're going to have warning signs you should watch for, parents, and all of our guests will be available for a final discussion about Satanism after this break.
On this altar, is one of a number of daggers which we may use in our rituals. This one happened to belong to the commanding general of the most elite unit of Germany's infamous SS, which was concerned with black magic and occultism research in general. Anything that it could find that had to do with the origins of the human race, destiny of humanity.
The perverted view of the occult held by Heinrich Himmler was of an evil magic that could help create a new master race. Wewelsburg Castle is where he performed his ceremonies.
I have been to the Wewelsburg, which still preserves Heinrich Himmler's ritual chambers to this day, and have conducted a black magical ritual in the so-called Hall of the Dead beneath the Wewelsburg. This particular dagger is inscribed to our comrade in the Leibstandarte, Theodor Wisch, Brigadefuhrer, a major general in the Waffen-SS. And on its blade, it bears the inscription, Mein Ehre heißt Treu, or My Honor Shall Be Known by My Faithfulness.
Intelligence agencies have infiltrated and created some satanic groups, with the resurgence of these groups beginning in 1966. Particularly with the birth of the Church of Satan, founded by Anton LaVey. LaVey studied criminology in San Francisco and worked in the San Francisco Police Department Crime Lab. He also worked as an informant for Interpol. Prior to the Church of Satan, LaVey ran a group called the Magic Circle. LaVey's most famous associate is the National Security Agency General Michael Aquino. At the time of his membership in LaVey's group, Aquino was an Army specialist in intelligence and psychological warfare. In 1973, he became the executive officer of the 306th Psychological Operations Battalion, contemporary with his founding of the Church of Set. General Michael Aquino wrote, "From PSYOP to Mind War, the Psychology of Victory." Aquino's thesis stated that enemy populations could be subdued by inflicting a state of psychological terror and feelings of imminent destruction. He discusses the use of psychotronic weapons or electromagnetic weapons that influence the mind. Capitulation could be induced without firing a shot by extremely low frequency signals piggybacked on broadcasts of radio, TV, or microwave communications in order to influence and manipulate the thoughts and feelings of the target population. During the 1960s, he was prominent in the Church of Satan and a close friend of Anton LaVey until he started his own Church of Set. A police intelligence report dated July 1, 1981 reads, quote, "The Church of Set is a group of hundreds of members that operates on a national level. Michael Aquino is the official head and rules through a council of nine who are in fact his lieutenants," unquote. At least two members of the Council of Nine at that time were members of Army Intelligence. In the late 1980s, Aquino was accused by the San Francisco Police Department of being involved in a satanic child molestation ring centered on the daycare at the Presidio military base where Aquino was stationed at the time. Probable victims numbered at 68, many of whom had contracted venereal disease. 22 families filed $66 million in claims against the Army, claiming that criminal charges against Michael Aquino were dropped due to pressure from the Army. General Aquino admitted to renting the German castle where the Nazi SS were formed and reenacting the secret ceremony among fellow intelligence officers dressed in full Nazi regalia.
What are the odds that Alex Jones, who would use Aquino's mind war tactics and language in his own info war, and just happened to be involved with a writer that would write about Aquino's new age military techniques? I just can't get past how many connections the Patriot Movement and Alex Jones have to these Contra and CIA and CNP operators. Larry Pratt and Pat Buchanan both worked for the Council on Inter-American Security, funneling money from South America. Then Pratt is a regular guest on Jones' show, the guy that said we needed Contra-style militias in the United States. Alex Jones worked on Pat the Jesuit Buchanan's campaign, and Khashoggi has a slew of fronts based in Minnesota, all with the name Genesis in them, just like Genesis Communications. Ah! Okay, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. We'll get into Jones and Khashoggi more later in the film. In 1999, Benacci won a $1 million lawsuit against Larry King, the former head of the Franklin Credit Union in Nebraska, whom he claimed had forced him into the pedophile ring. The federal judge ruled Benacci was truthful in his testimony, which included his claim that he was one of several young male prostitutes known to have toured the White House in the 1980s. Just as Johnny Gosch had CMP-related people involved in his kidnapping and abuse, Jeff Gannon, a.k.a. Jeff Guckert, also had high-level CMP connections involved in his life. Andy Stevenson, a blogger from Seattle familiar with the details of the Johnny Gosch case and the child sex rings in Nebraska detailed in the book The Franklin Cover-Up, began with a group of other writers and investigators to ponder this claim. They looked at markings on Gannon's body and compared them to those reported on Johnny Gosch. They considered the lack of personal information about Gannon's early years. They considered that Johnny was alleged to have been used as a gay prostitute for blackmail purposes. They also considered that the high-powered people alleged to have kidnapped and brainwashed children as a part of the government's Monarch program and MKUltra project, including Johnny, did so to use them in a variety of ways to advance their own agendas. And they contacted Noreen Gosch and discussed the idea with her, the first she'd heard of the theory, and they, too, came to the conclusion that Jeff Gannon is none other than Johnny Gosch. Jeff Gannon, a conservative journalist and gay male escort in Washington, D.C., was found to have gained access to the White House press pool despite using a fake name and despite the fact that he once worked as a high-priced homosexual escort. Jeff Gannon was a White House correspondent for Talon News who regularly attended White House press briefings and at least four press conferences with President George W. Bush on January 26, 2005. Gannon asked a question of the president that was so friendly and factually inaccurate that some of his colleagues began looking into his background. Talon News, it was learned, is a barely disguised tool of the Republican Party, and Gannon's credentials as a journalist consist solely of a training course at the Leadership Broadcast School of Journalism. After 2 days of training, that cost $50. Gannon was officially a graduate of a journalism school and on his way to the White House press pool. It was soon discovered that Gannon's real name is Jeff Guckert, and he was also going by the nickname Bulldog. When listing himself on the internet as homosexual escort and personal trainer charging $200 per hour for his discreet services. Gannon was removed from the White House and resigned from Talon News, and Gannongate quickly became the presidential scandal of the hour. Though the story faded from public view as politicians and the media eagerly turned their attention to such pressing matters as steroids in baseball and the Terry Schiavo situation. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan and former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer can't seem to get their story straight on precisely when, how, or why the White House became suspicious of the non-journalist Jeff Gannon, and when or how or why Gannon got a coveted White House press pass. First, McClellan told the press Gannon was admitted to the White House as a Talon News reporter, and that there was never any doubt about his legitimacy in that role. Then we were told that, in fact, he was admitted as a correspondent for a patently partisan non-journalistic enterprise. Next, Ari Fleischer disclosed that the White House had become suspicious of Gannon early on and checked out his employer, Talon News, to determine whether it was a legitimate news operation. That checking out involved nothing more than a phone call between Fleischer and a Republican activist, Bobby Eberle, to hear Fleischer tell it. No, not so, said McClellan. And in fact, the check involved a thorough review of Gannon's employer, which, says McClellan, was not Talon News at the time, but GOPUSA.com. McClellan said he didn't know Gannon, and now we find out that Gannon sent McClellan a card when the White House press secretary got married and was given a coveted invite to the White House's exclusive Christmas party, an event which, according to several White House correspondents, signifies that the White House believes a journalist is in good standing with the Washington establishment. More recent revelation suggests that the degrees of separation between Jeff Gannon, James Guckert, and Karl Rove is precisely one. Counsel for National Policy member Morton C. Blackwell, Rove's mentor and Gannon's teacher at the conservative quack factory, the Leadership Institute. In 1979, Blackwell founded the Leadership Institute, which has been devoted for over 25 years to turning out right-wing activists and journalists. Karl Rove is its best-known graduate. Blackwell ran the Youth for Reagan effort in 1980, served on Ronald Reagan's White House staff, and has been a Republican National Committee man from Virginia. He's a close associate of the ultra-reactionary Paul Weyrich, and was Blackwell, Weyrich, and Vigory who met with Jerry Falwell in 1979 to found the Moral Majority. In 1991, Blackwell became executive director of the Council for National Policy. Morton Blackwell appears to share many of Weyrich's elitist views and wrote a foreword to Pelino del Correa de Oliver's book, Nobility and Analogous Traditional Elites, in which he said, quote, "One does not have to accept papal infallibility to appreciate a case persuasively made using theological, moral, and prudential arguments. This book will convince many readers, whatever their faith, that good elites are legitimate, desirable, and yes, necessary." Hunter S. Thompson was allegedly linked to Larry King, as implicated in Paul Bonacci's testimony, in which the pedophile victim revealed that Thompson had directed a graphic snuff film made near Sacramento, California, at a location called the Bohemian Grove. Bonacci was flown numerous times across state lines for sexual exploitation to Washington, D.C. and other cities. He testified on videotape on May 14, 1990, for Nebraska State Police Investigator Gary Caradori. Bonacci said that while on a trip to Sacramento, he was forced at gunpoint to commit homosexual acts another boy before he watched other men do the same to him, after which the boy was shot in the head. A separate testimony to camp said Bonacci told him that Larry King was smiling and laughing the whole time the film was being shown as the men watched. They passed Nicholas, another victim, around and me as if we were toys and sexually abused us. Allegedly, Hunter S. Thompson was getting ready to reveal these facts when he died from an apparent suicide, which many people believe was actually murder. Thompson also began to question the official story of 9/11 shortly after the fact. As we can see, the pedophilia in the child sex rings reminiscent of the Jesuit and Vatican pedophiles is one of the many things CMP-related individuals have been involved in.
The Goshes track down the other paperboys that work with Johnny, and they tell a terrifying story.
The paper carrier saw this person in this Ford Fairmont stop, back up, and talk to Johnny.
The guy said, "Hey, kid, where's 86th Street? And Johnny turned to the older boy and said, "There's something wrong with this guy." He said, "I'm scared. I'm going home."
According to the paper carriers, as soon as Johnny started walking away, another stranger began following him on foot.
We don't feel that Johnny even realized he was being followed because the man stayed a ways behind.
Fearing something terrible has happened, the Goshes contact the police.
The officer at the time knew that this wasn't a runaway. This is something that was serious, so he called in area officers to come in and start doing a canvas of the neighborhood.
The police quickly discovered that a neighbor witnessed what happened to Johnny next. At the end of the block, Johnny was ambushed by the Ford Fairmont and the man seen following him on foot.
The car pulled up. Somebody jumped out, and just like that, they both grabbed him, threw him in the car, and they took off, screeching tires and running the stop sign.
Children have vanished.
We put this picture on a milk carton. That was the very first one that ever took place. I remember going to the dairy in Iowa and said, "Hey, can we do this?" And they thought it was a good idea.
The idea takes off. Soon, missing children are being profiled on milk cartons across the country. Many of these children are ultimately found. Not Johnny Gosch.
It's a bad dream.
A Nebraska convict by the name of Paul Bonacci tells the police that he knows firsthand what happened to Johnny.
Paul Bonacci said, "I helped with the Johnny Gosch kidnapping. I was the one in the car. I was in the back seat. I was the one that jumped out and grabbed Johnny's legs, while the man who followed Johnny grabbed his shoulders."
They had a couple of pictures of Johnny, and they said that this is the one that they wanted to get.
Bonacci says he's part of a vast network of sexual predators operating across the Midwest, a network that ensnared Bonacci himself when he was a teenager.
Paul Bonacci was a victim who was also used. These children, after they have been molested, they themselves become part and recruit other kids to be put into this. And as long as a boy behaves, he can survive.
Noreen sets up a face-to-face meeting with Paul Bonacci in prison.
I feel so bad about it because what they made me do.
Bonacci broke down and just cried when he saw me. And he said, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for what I did. But they forced me to.
Noreen is certain she finally knows what happened.
Never. And Jimmy knew it.
Jimmy Gibson also tells Noreen about a horrible identifying mark that all the boys held captive at the ranch now bear.
The brand is what they call the rocking X, like a half of a circle, and then there's an X in the center. Jimmy had that brand on his leg. Paul Benassi carries that brand. Jimmy told us that Johnny also carries that brand.
It's a story almost too sadistic to be true, but investigators are already familiar with the notorious Rocking X.
In the underground, we started observing and hearing about the Rocking X in about 1968-69. We had followed it out to somewhere in Colorado where there was a Rocking X operation going on. That was the last I knew of it. And then when Johnny came along and I saw the Rocking X again, I immediately knew what the Rocking X was.
Jimmy Gibson claims that many of the young boys managed to escape the ranch where Rocking X held them captive. Among them was Johnny Gosch. But Jimmy has no idea where Johnny is now.
We have a rule about using air quotes, you know, air quotes in the Newsnight office. We don't. But this story has tested the rule mightily. At its center is a so-called reporter for the Talon News Service, a website run by a Republican activist in Texas. The reporter, and many people take issue with his use of that label, resigned yesterday from covering the White House. But the story is much more than that. So we begin with CNN's Tom Foreman.
Al-Qaeda's second-in-command was...
On the radio, on the Internet, on dozens of TV channels, thousands of people call themselves journalists. And that is raising a sticky question. When it comes to access to the White House, which ones should be treated like real reporters?
Good afternoon, everybody.
Press Secretary Scott McClellan said today, when you have changing media, it's not an easy issue to decide or try to pick and choose who is a journalist. It gets into the issue of advocacy journalism. Where do you draw the line?
Good morning.
A question to the president by a conservative Internet reporter sparked the debate. Jeff Gannon of TalonNews.com took aim at Democratic senators last month.
How are you going to work with people who seem to have divorced themselves from reality?
Liberal websites called Gannon a shill for conservative interest. Congressional Democrats asked why he was allowed into the press briefing. Gannon is defending himself.
Well, Talon News is a legitimate conservative online news service. And my questions are things that my readers, 700,000 daily subscribed readers, want the answer to.
Still, under a torrent of what he calls unfair Internet assaults on his personal life and threats against his family, Gannon has resigned from Talon News. And even White House reporters who like him say that's for the best.
Getting a permanent press pass at the White House is difficult. Generally, only big news organizations can do it. But daily press passes are handed out to almost anyone in the media who passes a basic security test. That is how Jeff Gannon got inside for 2 years.
And although he is now gone, White House journalists say others with clearly political points of view remain, while the White House says it's not the administration's job to decide who is or is not a legitimate journalist. Tom Foreman, CNN, Washington.
As we said, this odd little story covers a lot of ground and raises a good many issues. There is, I think, here a kind of so what quality. Here's this guy. Everyone knows what he is. The only people, honestly, who read the website are people who believe what he believes to begin with. So why the fuss?
Aaron, I think the fuss isn't about this guy being a conservative, because I think the point's been made. There's a lot of conservatives, a lot of liberals in the press corps. The point is, this guy has a rather fishy background that the bloggers over the last couple of weeks at DailyCoast.com and also MyAmericaBlog.org have found out that you know, this guy's business experiences go back to dealing with some rather sort of shady websites a year or two before he was in the White House. He sets up his Talon News service on April 29th, I believe, of 2003. 6 days later, he's getting a White House pass to get in and ask press, you know, questions of the president. We then find out just a few months later that this journalist who just pops up out of nowhere is getting CIA documents in the Valerie Plame affair, which was the CIA agent that was outed with regards to the WMD and all of that. It's just the larger question here for me isn't, so what about this guy? Is he a journalist or not? But how did somebody get this kind of access to the White House and this kind of CIA information? I think the White House is behind this.
Let's come back to that. Eric, is there something a little unseemly about the way people went at this guy's personal life? I mean, this was about ultimately partisan differences, political differences, and they went at his personal life.
Right, and you know, and I think that's something the bloggers were obviously behind, and at Salon, that's not what we focused on. We focused on, as we talked about, what was the relationship between him and the White House? How did he get this access? But, you know, he was writing under a fake name. There's not many people in the press White House writing under a fake name. He was very mysterious about
it. They call that a pseudonym in your business, don't they?
You pick it, alias or whatever.
Yeah.
Not many people going to the press house writing under someone else's name.
Right.
Sort of mysterious about his past. And then so people started digging into both his past and this news agency. And a couple days ago, he posted this sort of aggressive essay on his website saying, "I'm hiding in plain sight, you know, come after me if you want to find out who I am," and people did.
So he did a sort of Gary Hart?
In a way, yeah. I mean, he wrote an essay, "I'm hiding in plain sight, and you liberals want to find out who I am, you know, start digging, there's nothing to find." Well, there was something to find.
Right.
But again, I think it's more interesting, how did he get this access? And, you know, it seems like the rules were bent at the White House to give a partisan a front row seat at the press room.
Well, here's what, I mean, what John, what the White House says is they don't really ask about your political affiliation on these daily passes. The correspondent corps doesn't pass judgment here. If you show an ID and you pass a Secret Service check, then you get to sit there and, if your number is drawn, you get to ask questions.
And that is the biggest bunch of hogwash I've ever heard. George Bush's White House controls everything that happens every second of the day. And anybody that thinks that that White House doesn't know everyone walking in the door, they threw out Sarah, I forget her name, I want to say McClanahan. Sarah McClendon, she got thrown out for 3 months in 2001 because they didn't like the questions she was asking. And she was told, for security reasons, this 90-year-old reporter couldn't come into the White House. They absolutely decide who does and doesn't come in that door. If you ask the wrong questions, they punish you. And for them to now suggest that some guy who had a shady business background, we're not talking about his personal life, we're talking about his business life. He told Wolf Blitzer earlier today that he was hired to construct some websites that basically the web address is dealt with escort services.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that. I think that raises enough of a red flag that at least you wonder if this man should be meeting with the President of the United States and getting CIA documents. That's all we're saying.
Got it. This isn't
personal. It's important.
Okay. Well, okay.
And the way it works in Washington, if you want to cover the White House, first you go to Capitol Hill. That's the first stop. You have to get credentials for Capitol Hill. And then if you want a hard pass, a permanent pass to the White House, you go to the White House, you fill out an application, and then the Secret Service does a background check. If you don't have Capitol Hill credentials, the White House won't even submit your application.
For a hard pass.
Yeah. Jeff Gannon went to Capitol Hill. They said, "You're not a real reporter. This is not a real news organization."
Right.
And then he spends 2 years in the White House press office getting these daily passes.
How did he get to ask the president a question 2 weeks ago? I mean, Eric, you know, and Aaron, you know as well. You don't just get to ask the president a question. That's planned in advance. These guys, there's something else going on here. This isn't just some journalist who happened to get in and happened to get a pass. They wanted him there. They scripted this. And I'm frankly wondering, again, how did he get involved with Valerie Plame? There's some unanswered question here higher up of somebody in the White House, and it brings us to the larger question of Armstrong Williams and everything else as far as the whole propaganda White House.
We'll leave it at that. It does raise lots of questions on having to do with media, having to do with what's appropriate, and in fact having to do with the White House and how it operates. Good to see you both tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in tonight.
One of the biggest questions I get in general about the Council for National Policy is whether or not Ron Paul and Alex Jones are members of this group. Now, why is it impossible for us to ascertain whether or not these men are indeed members, considering the fact that the Council for National Policy does not make their membership lists available to the public? We definitely see a lot of connections with both Ron Paul and Alex Jones, both to the Council for National Policy and the John Birch Society and the priest class itself. This is not mudslinging. This is not jealousy or hatred. This is questions. And